his eyes toward Rosslyn. Langdon felt a boyish craving to know her secrets. "Don't ask," he told himself. "This is not the moment." He glanced at the parchment in Marie's hand, and then back at Rosslyn.
"Ask the question, Mr. Langdon," Marie said, looking amused. "You have earned the right."
Langdon felt himself flush.
"You want to know if the Grail is here at Rosslyn?"
"Can you tell me?" She sighed in mock exasperation.
"Why is it that men simply cannot let the Grail rest?"
She laughed, obviously enjoying herself.
"Why do you think it's here?"
Langdon motioned to the parchment in her hand. "Your husband's poem speaks specifically of Rosslyn, except it also mentions a blade and chalice watching over the Grail. I didn't see any symbols of the blade and chalice up there."
"The blade and chalice?" Marie asked. "What exactly do they look like?"
Langdon sensed she was toying with him, but he played along, using his index finger to trace the symbols on his palm. "This is the blade," he said, outlining the symbol's simplest closed form for her. "It represents all that is masculine. A triangle." "And the inverse," Langdon said, drawing again on his palm, "is the chalice. It represents the feminine. An inverted triangle."
"Fascinating," Marie said. "And are you saying that in all the hundreds of symbols we have here in Rosslyn Chapel, these two triangles appear nowhere?"
"I didn't see them," Langdon said.
"And if I show them to you, will you get some sleep?"
Before Langdon could answer, Marie Chauvel had stepped off the porch and was heading toward the chapel. Langdon hurried after her. Marie entered the ancient building and turned on the lights, pointing to the center of the sanctuary floor.
"There you are, the blade and chalice."
Langdon stared at the scuffed stone floor. It was blank. "There's nothing here," Marie sighed, and began to walk along the famous path worn into the chapel floor. The same path Langdon had seen the visitors walking earlier this evening. As his eyes adjusted to see the giant symbol, he still felt lost. "But that's just the seal of Solomon." Langdon stopped short, mute with amazement as it dawned. The two triangles, superimposed. The six-pointed star. The blade and chalice, fused as one. The seal of Solomon. The perfect union of male and female, marking the Holy of Holies, where the male and female deities, Yahweh and Shekinah, were thought to dwell. Langdon needed a minute to find his words. "The verse does point here to Rosslyn, completely, perfectly." Marie smiled.
"Apparently."
The implications chilled him.
"So the Holy Grail is in the vault beneath us?"
She laughed.
"Only in spirit. One of the Priory's most ancient charges was one day to return the Grail to her homeland of France, where she could rest for eternity. For centuries she was dragged across the countryside to keep her safe, most undignified. Jacques' charge, when he became Grand Master, was to restore her honor by returning her to France and building her a resting place fit for a queen."
"And he succeeded?" Now her face grew serious.
"Mr. Langdon, considering what you've done for me tonight, and as curator of the Rosslyn Trust, I can tell you for certain that the Grail is no longer here."
Langdon decided to press.
"But the keystone is supposed to point to the place where the Holy Grail is hidden now. Why does it point to Rosslyn?"
"Maybe you're misreading its meaning. Remember, the Grail can be deceptive, as could my late husband."
"But how much clearer could he be?" he asked. "We are standing over an underground vault, marked by the blade and chalice, underneath a ceiling of stars, surrounded by the art of master masons. Everything speaks of Rosslyn."
"Very well. Let me see this mysterious verse."
She unrolled the parchment
and read the poem aloud, in a deliberate tone.
The Holy Grail, 'neath ancient Rosalind waits, with blade and chalice guarding o'er her gates. Adorned in master's loving art she lies. She rests at last beneath the starry skies.
When she finished, she was still for several seconds, until a knowing smile crossed her lips.
Ah, Jacques.
Langdon watched her expectantly. You understand this?
As you have witnessed on the chapel floor, Mr. Langdon, there are many ways to see simple things.
Langdon strained to understand. Everything about Jacques Saunière seemed to have double meanings, and yet Langdon could see no further. Marie gave a tired yawn.
Mr. Langdon, I will make a confession to you. I have never officially been privy to the location of the Grail, but of course I was married to a person of enormous influence, and my woman's intuition is strong.
Langdon started to speak, but Marie continued.
I am sorry that after all your hard work, you will be leaving Rosslyn without any real answers. And yet, something tells me you will eventually find what you seek. One day, it will dawn on you.
She smiled.
And when it does, I trust that you, of all people, can keep a secret.
There was a sound of someone arriving in the doorway.
You both disappeared, Sophie said.
I was just leaving,
her grandmother replied, walking over to Sophie at the door.
Good night, princess.
She kissed Sophie's forehead.
Don't keep Mr. Langdon out too late.
Langdon and Sophie watched her grandmother walk back toward the Fieldstone house. When Sophie turned to him, her eyes were awash in deep emotion.
Not exactly the ending I expected.
That makes two of us, he thought. Langdon could see she was overwhelmed. The news she had received tonight had changed everything in her life. Are you okay? It's a lot to take in. She smiled quietly.
I have a family. That's where I'm going to start. Who we are and where we came from will take some time.
Langdon remained silent.
Beyond tonight, will you stay with us?
Sophie asked.
At least for a few days.
Langdon sighed, wanting nothing more.
You need some time here with your family, Sophie. I'm going back to Paris in the morning.
She looked disappointed, but seemed to know it was the right thing to do. Neither of them spoke for a long time. Finally, Sophie reached over and, taking his hand, led him out of the chapel. They walked to a small rise on the bluff. From here, the Scottish countryside spread out before them, suffused in a pale moonlight that sifted through the departing clouds. They stood in silence, holding hands, both of them fighting the descending shroud of exhaustion. The stars were just now appearing, but to the east, a single point of light glowed brighter than any other. Langdon smiled when he saw it. It was Venus, the ancient goddess, shining down with her steady and patient light. The night was growing cooler, a crisp breeze rolling up from the lowlands. After a while, Langdon looked over at Sophie. Her eyes were closed, her lips relaxed in a contented smile. Langdon could feel his own eyes growing heavy. Reluctantly, he squeezed her hand. Sophie? Slowly, she opened her eyes and turned to him. Her face was beautiful in the moonlight. She gave him a sleepy smile.
Hi.
Langdon felt an unexpected sadness to realize he would be returning to Paris without her. I may be gone before you wake up. He paused, a knot growing in his throat.
I'm sorry, I'm not very good at...
Sophie reached out and placed her soft hand on the side of his face. Then, leaning forward, she kissed him tenderly on the cheek.
When can I see you again?
Langdon reeled momentarily, lost in her eyes.
When?
He paused, curious, if she had any idea how much he'd been wondering the same thing. Well, actually next month I'm giving a couple of lectures at a conference in Florence. I'll be there a week without much to do.
Is that an invitation?
We'd be living in luxury. They're giving me a room at the Brunelleschi. Sophie smiled playfully.
You presume a lot, Mr. Langdon.
He cringed at how it had sounded. What I meant...
I would love nothing more than to meet you in Florence, Robert, but only on one condition.
Her tone turned serious.
No museums, no churches, no tombs, no art, no relics.
In Florence? For a week? There's nothing else to do. Sophie leaned forward and kissed him again, now on the lips. Their bodies came together softly at first, and then completely. When she pulled away, her eyes were full of promise.
Right, Langdon managed. It's a date.
Epilogue. Robert Langdon awoke with a start. He had been dreaming. The monogram on his bathrobe read, Hotel Ritz, Paris. He saw a dim light filtering through the blinds. Is it dusk or dawn? He wondered. Langdon's body felt warm and deeply contented. He had slept the better part of the last 2 days. Sitting up slowly in bed, he now realized what had awoken him. The strangest thought. The last several days had been a barrage of information, but now Langdon considered something he'd not thought of before.
Could it be?
He remained motionless a long moment. Getting out of bed, he walked to the marble shower and let the powerful jets massage his shoulders. Still, the thought enthralled him.
Impossible.
It was 20 minutes later that Langdon stepped from Hotel Ritz out into Place Vendôme. Night was falling. The days of sleep had left him disoriented, and yet his mind felt oddly lucid. He had promised himself he would stop in the hotel lobby for a café au lait to clear his thoughts, but instead his legs carried him directly out the front door into the gathering Paris night. Walking east on Rue des Petits Champs, Langdon felt a growing excitement. He turned south onto Rue Richelieu, where the air grew sweet with the scent of blossoming jasmine from the stately gardens of the Palais Royal. He continued south until he saw what he was looking for. The famous Royal Arcade, a glistening expanse of polished black marble. Moving onto it, Langdon scanned the surface beneath his feet. Within seconds, he found what he knew was there. Several bronze medallions embedded in the ground in a perfectly straight line. Each disc was 5 inches in diameter and embossed with the letters N and S. Nord. Sud. He turned due south, letting his eye trace the extended line formed by the medallions. He began moving again, following the trail, watching the pavement as he walked. As he cut across the corner of Comédie Française, another bronze medallion passed beneath his feet.
Yes!
The streets of Paris, Langdon had learned years ago, were adorned with 135 of these bronze markers, embedded in sidewalks, courtyards, and streets, on a north-south axis across the city. He had once followed the line from Sacré-Cœur, north across the Seine, and finally to Paris's ancient astronomical observatory. There, he discovered the significance of the sacred path it traced. The Earth's original prime meridian. The first zero longitude of the world. Paris's ancient rose line. Now, as Langdon hurried across Rue de Rivoli, he could feel his destination within reach, less than a block away. The Holy Grail, neath ancient Rosalind, waits. The revelations were coming now in waves. Saunière's ancient spelling of Rosalind, the blade and chalice, the tomb adorned with master's art. Is that why Saunière needed to talk with me? Had I unknowingly guessed the truth? He broke into a jog, feeling the rose line beneath his feet guiding him, pulling him toward his final destination. As he entered the long tunnel of Passage Richelieu, the hair on his neck began to bristle with anticipation. He knew that at the end of this tunnel stood the grandest of Parisian monuments, conceived and commissioned in the 1980s by the Sphinx himself, François Mitterrand, a man rumored to move in secret circles, a man whose final legacy to Paris was a place Langdon had visited only days before. Another lifetime. With a final surge of energy, Langdon burst from the passageway into the familiar courtyard and came to a stop. Breathless, he raised his eyes slowly, disbelieving, to the glistening structure in front of him. The Louvre Pyramid, gleaming in the darkness. He admired it only a moment. He was more interested in what lay to his right. Turning, he felt his feet again tracing the invisible path of the ancient rose line, carrying him across the courtyard to the Carrousel du Louvre, the enormous circle of grass surrounded by a perimeter of neatly trimmed hedges. Once the site of Paris's primeval nature-worshipping festivals, joyous rites to celebrate fertility and the goddess. Langdon felt like he was crossing into another world as he stepped over the bushes to the grassy area within. This hallowed ground was now marked by one of the city's most unusual monuments. There in the center, plunging into the earth like a crystal chasm, gaped the giant inverted pyramid of glass that he had seen a few nights ago when he entered the Louvre's subterranean entresol, La Pyramide Inversée. Tremulous, Langdon walked to the edge and peered down into the Louvre's sprawling underground complex, aglow with amber light. His eye was trained not just on the massive inverted pyramid, but on what lay directly beneath it. There, on the floor of the chamber below, stood the tiniest of structures, a structure Langdon had mentioned in his manuscript. Langdon felt himself awaken fully now to the thrill of unthinkable possibility. Raising his eyes again to the Louvre, he sensed the huge wings of the museum enveloping him, hallways that burgeoned with the world's finest art, Da Vinci, Botticelli. Adorned in master's loving art, she lies. Alive with wonder, he stared once again downward through the glass at the tiny structure below. I must go down there. Stepping out of the circle, he hurried across the courtyard, back toward the towering pyramid entrance of the Louvre. The day's last visitors were trickling out of the museum. Pushing through the revolving door, Langdon descended the curved staircase into the pyramid. He could feel the air grow cooler. When he reached the bottom, he entered the long tunnel that stretched beneath the Louvre's courtyard, back toward La Pyramide Inversée. At the end of the tunnel, he emerged into a large chamber. Directly before him, hanging down from above, gleamed the inverted pyramid, a breathtaking V-shaped contour of glass. The chalice. Langdon's eyes traced its narrowing form downward to its tip, suspended only 6 feet above the floor. There, directly beneath it, stood a tiny structure. A miniature pyramid, only 3 feet tall. The only structure in this colossal complex that had been built on a small scale. Langdon's manuscript, while discussing the Louvre's elaborate collection of goddess art, had made passing note of this modest pyramid. The miniature structure itself protrudes up through the floor as though it were the tip of an iceberg, the apex of an enormous pyramidal vault submerged below like a hidden chamber. Illuminated in the soft lights of the deserted entresol, the two pyramids faced one another, their bodies perfectly aligned, their tips almost touching. The chalice above, the blade below. The blade and chalice guarding o'er her gates. Langdon heard Marie Chauvel's words.
One day it will dawn on you.
He was standing beneath the ancient rose line, surrounded by the work of masters. What better place for Sonier to keep watch? Now at last, he sensed he understood the true meaning of the Grand Master's verse. Raising his eyes to heaven, he gazed upward through the glass, to a glorious star-filled night. She rests at last, beneath the starry skies. Like the murmurs of spirits in the darkness, forgotten words echoed. The quest for the Holy Grail is the quest to kneel before the bones of Mary Magdalene, a journey to pray at the feet of the outcast one. With a sudden upwelling of reverence, Robert Langdon fell to his knees. For a moment, he thought he heard a woman's voice, the wisdom of the ages, whispering up from the chasms of the earth.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown. This program was read by Paul Michael, produced and directed by Janet Stark. Text copyright 2003 by Dan Brown. Production copyright 2003, Books on Tape, Incorporated. All rights reserved.
I'm with Akiva Goldsman, screenwriter for The Da Vinci Code. When you originally read The Da Vinci Code, did you already know that you were going to be writing the screenplay, and how did that affect your opinion of the book?
Well, I hadn't actually read The Da Vinci Code. I had heard of it, and I knew that the book existed in galleys first, because it was sort of a slight stir in Hollywood when the book sale occurred. When I read Da Vinci Code for the first time, it was after Ron Howard had called me and asked me to adapt it. And I must say, my first emotion was fear. Tremendous, spiking fear.
Did part of that stem from the fact that a record-breaking number of people have read this novel? Was tackling this big a bestseller at all intimidating?
Well, when I was first considering adapting it, Da Vinci Code had not quite become the monster, the all-time heavyweight champion of book sales in the universe. It was simply a phenomenal bestseller. My fear originated from what seemed to me, at first glance, the deeply unfilmic nature of the narrative. So much of what is riveting about Da Vinci Code is backstory. It's the ability to see our present in a way that is fresh, because we learn about our past and learn things about them culturally that we didn't know. And this sort of creates a new perspective. It's a wonderful thing to do if you have pages upon pages upon pages. But in screenplay form, you know, you have to convert all that information to something that is more visual. And the other problem for me, as I faced this sort of daunting notion, was it's full of talk. Basically, what people do in Da Vinci Code is they talk to each other all the time. And although as writers we all love words, the idea of moving that talk to pictures was pretty intimidating. You know, Dan Brown has two things going for him in The Da Vinci Code. One is, it's a pretty good yarn. It's a really fascinating page-turner, literally. I think more profoundly, people believe there is more to the world than we see. I think we are fundamentally fascinated by the idea of the world behind the world. I think we are more interested often in shadows than in bright light. And Dan did something remarkable. He took everything that we believe about our cultural backstory and turned it on its head. He sort of opened a window into seeing who we are and how we got here. And speculative fiction that it may be, it had enough truth and enough of the ring of truth to really land nationally and globally.
Did you work at all with Dan Brown while you were writing the screenplay?
You know, it's funny. Dan and I encountered each other for the first time after I had written the first draft. And this is typically not the most intimate or loving of relationships, that of author and adapter. And I think we both were very wary of each other at first. And what we discovered about each other after the first and then the second draft and on into revisions was that we both were very thoughtful about the material, that I was not attempting to change, I was trying to translate, that I cared about his imagined world in a way that most people wouldn't have to, because I had to inhabit it after he had built it and sort of rebuild it from the inside. And we were both very direct, and we went from this wary circling to a kind of fantastic friendship, which existed during the course of the movie. Often we would go, where's Dan? Call Dan. What would Dan say about this? And, you know, up through, you know, today when we exchanged emails, he's really a friend of the movie and sort of a, over time became a real collaborator in terms of its evolution. And that was really fun because clearly nobody understands the Da Vinci Code better than Dan.
The Da Vinci Code will be your third collaboration with director Ron Howard, in addition to Cinderella Man and A Beautiful Mind. What is your working relationship like with Mr. Howard?
You know, Ron believes in the participation of writer during filming process, which whenever I am producing, I believe in as well. It is an odd thing, the exclusion of writer that is typical in Hollywood. Every component of filming requires both planning and improvisation. And what I mean by that is the director of photography will, in collaboration with the director, make a plan for shooting before the filming begins. And this plan will really speak to an approach that is specific to the scene, and it will be planned out for every scene. So too will the production designer work with the director to make a plan for every set. So too will the costume designer work in pre-production to make a plan for every bit of wardrobe a character may wear in the movie. Then when filming begins, each of these department heads is asked to improvise, to accommodate the actual circumstance. Well, we designed this set, but in fact, in truth, the light doesn't really work that way. So what if we actually moved the desk here and put the window there? Well, we were going to shoot this way, cinematographer and director say. But in fact, what we realize now is when we shoot the actor from that side, she doesn't look anywhere near as good as when we shoot her from this side. And, you know, we don't really like that angle. So let's accommodate and improvise on the day. Wardrobe person will come running out to the director and say, well, I know we agreed in pre-production that he would wear that giant beret, but you know, he's wearing it today and neither he nor I think it looks good. And the collaboration of director and costume designer will improvise. Well, there's no more planning than the planning that goes into a screenplay. The director and the writer and the actors make a plan. That's what a screenplay is. It's a collaborative plan for the words that will be said during the day. And then what happens on the day is what happens in every other department. Things change. The movie teaches you how to make the movie. Relationships have evolved in the scenes previously in ways that you didn't anticipate on the page, and so people improvise. But typically in Hollywood, for some reason, the writer isn't there. So it's left to everybody who happens to be standing to make it up on the day. Now, you would never do that with the cinematography. You wouldn't say, well, I know we're going to shoot it that way. Who's got an idea for a lens? You would never do it with costumes. Hey, you know, anybody got a scarf for him? But that's exactly what happens with words. We don't like this line. Anybody got a better idea? And it's crazy because words are a tremendously fundamental component of the filmed experience. So words should have their own department head too. And more directors are understanding, and certainly Ron is someone who is a real proponent of this, that you should have somebody there whose job it is to do words so that it's not left to whoever happens to be there, the actor, the director, the grip, the guy serving donuts to come up with a better line, which, by the way, doesn't mean that all those people can't or shouldn't, but just as anyone could have a good idea on any piece of filmmaking, but there should be someone there with their eye on the sound of the picture as their sole and dedicated job, which is what I do, which is really fun.
Before you wrote this screenplay, had you visited any of the many famous locations in the book?
I had been to some of the Da Vinci hotspots previously. My wife is British, so I'd wandered through Westminster Abbey. I had actually never been to Temple Church before. I, like everybody else, I think, had no idea it existed. But no, I'm not one for touring much. The place I had been briefly in my youth was the Louvre, but nothing prepared me for the experience of, you know, shooting at the Louvre. It was impossibly spectacular. In the first place, we were shooting in Paris at night in the summer, which means that your nights are about 6 hours long. It's almost never dark. So first, the amount of spare time you have is extraordinary. And then we were shooting in the Louvre, and you can only shoot in the Louvre for those hours of darkness because the ceilings are glass. So you really are very limited. You have to load your equipment in and out every day because there are tourists coming, which takes an hour on each end. So you're basically shooting for 4 hours. And in that time, you are locked in alone with the greatest works of art ever to be collected. And it's everything you imagine. There were security guards everywhere, but short of that, you could wander through the museum. I think it was probably more spectacular for us than it will even be for the movie, because in fairness, it's very hard to shoot at the Louvre. There's one very interesting and stringent requirement, which is you're not allowed to shine light on the paintings. So many of the paintings in the movie are actually reproductions. We rebuilt the Louvre on stage at Shepperton and reproduced virtually every painting from the Grand Gallery. Because short of shots where the paintings exist in the background, close-ups were impossible.
While you're working on screenplays, do you cast the film in your mind? Do you envision actors who could play or who you'd like to have play the various characters?
I don't generally write with actors in mind. You end up writing for actors if you stay on the project, certainly. You know, I mean, the odd thing about screenplays is we talk about them as if there are fixed objects, but they're really very fluid. And there are certainly several distinct incarnations of them. You know, it's interesting because one can buy the shooting script of many screenplays, including The Da Vinci Code, and students read them, or avid screenwriters read them, and they think, wow, well, this is what a screenplay should look like. And it's terribly deceptive because the script that you shoot is never the script that you sell or the script that you've written. First, the first draft of a script is far more evocative, necessarily, somewhat more novelistic, because it's the writer's job to paint the idea of the movie in the mind of the reader, not in order for it to be executed, but weirdly to inspire the reader, generally a director or an actor, to want to do their version of it. And by the time you get to the shooting script, the document is actually a reflection of everybody's work. And weirdly, a cleaning out of a lot of the more evocative components because they've been replaced with very practical things like camera moves, etc. So by the time the shooting script is written, you've sat with, in this case, I was lucky enough to sit with Tom. It's something that Ron and I do. We sit with the actors and what we call grind the script. We sit and we call them rehearsals, but they're really script workshops where we sit with the cast and we read the scenes out loud and we improvise and we put them on their feet. And over time, what appears on the page is really the sound of the actor as he has inhabited the sounds that you've written.
So once the Da Vinci Code was actually cast, what changes did you end up making to the screenplay?
The script changed endlessly. I mean, if you look at the shooting script, you know, there are different colors for different revisions, and we're at 27 colors. I mean, I changed things on the day before, and we spent a month in this rehearsal process, which is something that is this great joy of sort of collaboration where, you know, we sit together with the actors and we workshop the script. And then at night I write in order to reflect what we've done during the day. I sort of, you get a lot of information on the day. Then you take it back to your hotel room and you work it and you sort of see what works and what doesn't. And then you tweak it or you play with it or you throw it away. But it's this great process of sort of, you know, it's like beating a rag or a rug against the rocks, you know, to sort of really get the cleanest version. It's really fun.
Cinderella Man, A Beautiful Mind, and now The Da Vinci Code all have protagonists fighting tremendous battles. Gentleman Jim Braddock against the boxing establishment, John Nash against his own mind, and now Robert Langdon against a massive conspiracy. What attracts you to this kind of character?
Well, I think characters who are struggling with what is or isn't valuable about their lives is a pretty profound opportunity for drama. Movies, when they work, for me, generate some sort of wonder. And often that's paired with recognition. It's a kind of revisioning of what you have, a new way of seeing what's in front of you. So for me, I think that's what links those characters.
The Da Vinci Code includes subject matter that many have found, to say the least, controversial. Did you feel any pressure to avoid or change these topics in the film?
I think generally the adaptation is pretty much a balancing act between trying to stay true to the book and trying to be useful in a sort of filmically narrative way. Basically, the issues we were juggling was what makes good movie and how do you keep as much of the book as possible. We didn't really consider the political ramifications because we took the book to be speculative fiction. And there's a tremendously long tradition of speculative fiction. The fact that this is inflammatory is simply because people have decided to take it as gospel, if you excuse the phrase. You know, no one ever said it was all true, even Dan Brown. He just said that pieces of it are true, and that's what good speculative fiction is. I mean, listen, I grew up reading In Search of Ancient Astronauts, you know, by Eric von Daniken, and he was really convinced and convincing that those pyramids were alien landing sites, and everybody talked about it. Well, maybe, but it was certainly fun to get our teeth into. Somehow, we now live in a time where that kind of speculation seems more dangerous, or maybe it's simply that this topic is more inflammatory, but that is the joy of the human imagination. We get to choose to believe what we want to believe. And if this book offers up an opportunity for people to debate what they believe and to look at their precepts, that's fantastic. Dan's done a great job and a great service to all of us.
What is it like for you? How do you feel to be such an integral part of what is undoubtedly the most highly anticipated film of the year?
Nervous, excited, lucky. You know, generally, movies are this weird, fragmented experience. A director I worked with at the beginning of my career, Joel Schumacher, used to always say to me, our movie is when we make it, and once it's released, it's theirs. It's true. There are two distinct experiences. Well, there's several, but in this case, the making of the movie, if the experience is collaborative and effective, if you feel you're working whatever the muscles you are that you bring to the job well, is your movie. It's the movie you were part of. It is a postmodern version of summer camp. And then you release it into the world, and generally, it has only the expectations generated by the components of it. And so, you know, there's this movie that Ron Howard directed that Russell Crowe is going to star in. And it's about this guy who, you know, suffers from schizophrenia. And that has a kind of wave of anticipation, but in all fairness, it's mild. You know, people are not sitting there rubbing their palms going, aha, fantastic. This movie about schizophrenia. And the movie gets to find its own size. And when it works, it's fantastic. When it doesn't, it's disheartening. But there's never quite been anticipation like there is with this one. I mean, Da Vinci Code is truly the most giant object in terms of entertainment commerce that's come along in quite a while. So generally, what we've attempted to do, and I think pretty effectively, is entirely ignore it, entirely ignore the scope of anticipation. Having said that, we're now just finishing the movie, and we can ignore it no longer. And it's quite a thing. I mean, it's like, it's very exciting to imagine the number of people that will rush to see this the second it opens. It's also anxiety provoking. You know, it's like being naked in front of a lot of strangers. You know, you keep doing push-ups and hope that you've done enough of them.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsman.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure.
Can you imagine the thrill of a father introducing a son to a gathering like this? Especially when father and son share with all of you a love for the humanities. As Dan's dad, I may be able to share with you a few things that you haven't read in the press or seen on TV. First and foremost, from the Brown family's perspective, Dan's most important achievement lies not in writing the Da Vinci Code, but rather in marrying Blythe. She brings to our family great warmth, joy, imagination, and incredible creativity. And she brings to you, the readers, a good bit of research behind Dan's books. As a father, I can tell you that both Dan and Blythe have seen their lives dramatically changed. Yet, in the truly important ways in which they live their lives, they are unchanged. They continue to be the same altruistic and unaffected people they were before worldwide recognition hit. For example, Dan continues to volunteer in the Big Brothers Big Sister program, going to his little brother's baseball, basketball, and football games, and closely monitoring the boys' schoolwork. And Dan remains the same modest self he was before the Da Vinci Code. When last spring he appeared in Time magazine's list of the world's 100 most influential people, Dan would be the first to tell you that Time had made a great, great mistake. Well, he may say that, but as one of two Dan's totally unbiased parents, I hope you will indulge me as I suggest that perhaps Time did not make a mistake when they cited Dan as the author of, quote, the novel that ate the world. A book with nearly 40 million copies published worldwide in 48 languages. The only book more widely distributed is the Bible. The so-called novel that ate the world has led to renewed interest in early Christian history, particularly in the Gnostic texts. Churches report overflowing crowds turning up for discussions of the novel. Some colleges and universities now have courses centered on the novel. And some courses, some colleges, require incoming students to read the book before they appear at freshman orientation. The novel has sparked intense debate. Could the theories proposed by Dan's characters possibly be true? Or are they, in the words of some church officials, pure poppycock? As a teacher, I applaud the debate. Teachers love topics that engage their students in passionate discussion, as there is nothing more stultifying to a classroom than apathy. I believe the same is true for religion. Dialogue is a great antidote for apathy. Connie and I learned firsthand how the novel ate the world when we were in Scotland and England to see some of the filming of the Da Vinci Code. While there, the curator of Roslyn Chapel outside Edinburgh and priests at Westminster Abbey and at the Templar Church in London told us of the huge, huge increase in tourism. The same is reported in Paris and Rome. Let me tell you just one more way in which Dan has indirectly impacted the world. Geraldo Pereira is a Brazilian publisher whose unprecedented success with Dan's books has led him to establish a trust fund, the first of its kind in Brazil, to help the most needy in the slums of Rio de Janeiro. The trust has two main purposes. The fund helps educate girls and young women, teaching them skills for employment that will keep them from or lift them out of prostitution. The fund also gives special assistance to the elderly in needs of physiotherapy, nursing, cultural, and recreational activities, allowing them, in Mr. Pereira's words, to have a more pleasant and worthy end of life. One wonders how many other such stories there are around the world. Let me conclude these introductory remarks with a personal anecdote. It used to be that my wife and I would be introduced to strangers as Connie and Dick Brown. No longer. We are introduced as Dan Brown's parents. So, in the spirit of reciprocity, I would like to introduce to you Connie and Dick Brown's son.
Thank you. That is the first time I've been introduced by both a president and my dad. So, the last time I spoke was in New Hampshire about a year and a half ago. That was the day the Manchester Union Leader ran a cartoon that showed Satan, the devil, sitting in hell, smiling contentedly as he read a copy of the Da Vinci Code. The accompanying article was equally generous in spirit. That was also the night that a prominent state official quietly took me aside and congratulated me on the dubious honor of being beat up by the union leader without even running for office. So when Jack asked me to come and speak in Manchester, I was a little leery, but I've been out of town. I don't know if there are any more cartoons, but if there are, my mom has a scrapbook, and if you could just cut it out for her. I'm currently on hiatus from public speaking, but tonight I decided to make an exception. As Jack said, I wanted to be here for a number of reasons. First and foremost, this is New Hampshire. This is the state that I love more than anywhere in the world. And second, this is the humanities. The Humanities Council has a mission that goes to the core of what I believe, celebrating the joy of learning, connecting people with ideas, and, of course, fostering civil debate, which apparently I've done a little of with a little book called The Da Vinci Code. When Jack asked me to come tonight, I guess you already know that he's the president in the Da Vinci Code, and it's really difficult to say no to your own president. My agent and my editor were not overly thrilled with my wanting to come here tonight. They really wanted me to stay in the bubble, stay focused on the book. But I told them I didn't have a choice in the matter, that the president had called upon me, and he needed my service, and I was going to report for duty. My editor is now urging me to impeach Jack in the next novel. So, before I dive into controversial topics like science and religion, I thought I'd once again ignore the advice of my editor and my agent and talk a little bit about a topic that is currently veiled in secrecy, that is Ron Howard's upcoming film of The Da Vinci Code. I should warn you, if you've ever heard authors speak about movies, authors seldom have anything nice to say about film adaptations of their books. Any of you who follow Hollywood may know, I really didn't want to sell these film rights. The book was a bestseller, and I had the luxury of being able to pay my rent without Hollywood's help. I was writing a trilogy and was only two-thirds of the way through. I wanted to wait. And also, the Hollywood machine has a pretty good track record of leaving disappointed authors in its wake. I'm not going to recount the long story of how and why this movie was actually made. Suffice to say that eventually the right people got involved, and I started to believe that a great movie of The Da Vinci Code could be made. I started to believe it was possible to capture some of the book's big ideas and make an authentic, thought-provoking movie that was more than just a bunch of car chases through Paris. So last year, I said yes to Hollywood. Not long after that, Ron Howard and a world-class cast began turning The Da Vinci Code into a movie. Blythe and I have spent a lot of this year on the set, and it has been quite an experience, exactly the opposite of writing a book, which is a very solitary experience. Making a movie is a collaboration of just epic proportions. Beyond the sheer scope of the production, what was amazing to us is that everything was happening behind a veil of secrecy that really is unprecedented in modern movie-making history. The set is closed. There is no press. There are very few visitors. No public statements from Sony or from Imagine Entertainment. The entire cast and crew is like some kind of strange secret society now, carrying out their work with a code of silence. And these people take it pretty seriously. That code of silence, by the way, will remain in effect until May 19th when the movie comes out. Tonight, however, I thought it would be harmless fun to lift that veil just a tiny bit and share with you just a glimpse of what's going on over there. The novelist is always the adaptation's most skeptical audience. But I've got to tell you, I think this movie will blow people away. The script has emerged as powerful and thought-provoking. The locations are enigmatic and gorgeous, and the cast is world-class. I truly believe moviegoers will come out of the theater feeling like they have just watched the novel. In June, Blythe and I had our first experience on the set. Filming began at the Louvre in Paris, and I've got to tell you, it is a strange experience to be in the Louvre after hours, have it be deserted, and to be walking around looking at paintings with a flashlight. Stranger still when a pale monk goes drifting by, or you hear somebody scream in agony. I kept a diary this summer of things I wanted to remember about the set, and one of the pages is marked things you thought you'd never hear. And I've got a whole list of things I heard on the movie set that I really thought I would never hear. And in the Louvre, there was a quote from a crew member. This was about 4 o'clock in the morning, coming out of a side room, one of the galleries. Somebody said, "Go for it, just don't splatter any blood on the Caravaggio." Things you never thought you'd hear. Last week we were at Roslyn Chapel in Edinburgh. This chapel, you've probably seen pictures of it, or maybe some of you have been there, built in 1550, a tiny chapel just covered in symbols and codes. This is real Robert Langdon territory. We were watching a little French girl, about 10, who was playing young Sophie, lying in the pews looking up at the codes in the ceiling. We filmed a terrific scene down in the crypt. There were just a lot of chills that day. Some of the chills were what we were filming. Some were that it was bitter cold in Scotland, and some were that my parents were on the set, which was a little nerve-wracking that first day. I was wondering if my mom would just sort of flip out when she met Tom Hanks, or if my dad was going to try to help Ron by calculating camera angles or something like that. But as it turned out, my parents were absolutely fantastic, and everybody on set just fell in love with them. I do have a couple of great quotes from those 2 days at Roslyn under the topic of things you never thought you'd hear. My mom, on the first day, said something along the lines of, "I don't know whether to sit on the executive producer or on Bishop Aringarosa." Now, things you never thought you'd hear. I've got all the chairs are marked with names, and you just never know where to sit. So that's what that was all about. My dad said, "I just met the entire Priory of Sion. Nice folks." But my favorite quote that day came from a production assistant It was the first day, cold and windy. We were in this ancient stone chapel about to film a touching scene when this assistant opens his door, sticks his head in, and yells, again, something you never thought you'd hear, "Ron, good news. Lady Rosalind called. She said you guys can use the bathroom in her castle." Lady Rosalind was terrific, by the way, and my parents, Blythe, and I actually had tea with her in Rosalind Castle, an absolutely surreal experience. Our last night in Edinburgh, we were having a party to celebrate a successful shoot at Rosalind, and it was going to be a big party with a bagpiper and haggis, which I'm glad they didn't serve this evening, a bagpiper. It was going to be a real, you know, a lot of Scotch whiskey, a real Scottish affair. And a whole lot of us decided that we would rent kilts and make a surprise grand entrance. So we rented these fancy kilts, and nobody had any idea how to put them on. So we were in the hotel room trying to essentially figure out how to get dressed. Some of the guys had had a little bit too much to drink, and we're all there sort of in various states of undress, trying to figure out how to put these on, when Akiva Goldsman, the screenwriter who's become a dear friend, turned to me and said something I never thought I would hear. He said, "Dan, when you wrote the first page of The Da Vinci Code, did you ever imagine you'd be standing half naked in Tom Hanks's hotel room trying on skirts with Ron Howard?" I sheepishly admitted that this exact scenario in the hotel room had been my life's goal, and that writing The Da Vinci Code and selling it to Ron was the only way I could imagine making it happen. In any case, Ron's movie is going to be terrific, and I am one very lucky author to feel that way. Which, I guess, leaves us with a question: what does any of this have to do with science and religion? Absolutely nothing. I was just, I just got off a plane, and I'm excited about the movie. I thought I'd share some of that with you. I think it's about 4 a.m. my time. So is any of this making sense? We usually think of science and religion as opposites, and yet they have a whole lot in common. Both have their own code of rigid beliefs, their own vocabularies, their own legions of passionate followers, many of whom are closed-minded to the other's way of thinking. But it's not surprising that they have these similarities, considering there was a time when science and religion were exactly the same thing. For the ancients, the science of the movement of the planets, the movement of the oceans and the tides, was nothing but the shifting moods of Poseidon. The science of thunder and lightning was synonymous with the god Thor, who threw thunderbolts. The biology of a pandemic disease, this was understood as a plague sent by God. Thousands of years ago, man had a huge pantheon of gods to explain just about everything that he didn't understand, from tornadoes to infertility. This kind of religion, in modern scientific terms, is based on an idea called proof from incredulity. In other words, I am incredulous that X could be a natural occurrence, therefore it must be caused by God. This is also known as God of the gaps. When there are gaps in mankind's understanding, he fills them with God. Over time, science began removing some of these gaps, and the pantheon of gods started to shrink. We came to understand the science of lightning, and Thor was banished as a false god. So in light of this decreasing pantheon of gods, one might expect that our need for God is decreasing. But in fact, if you looked at the strength of world religion today, it appears that this isn't so. In fact, our need for God has not decreased. It's simply becoming more focused. We no longer turn to God for answers as to why the skies drop hail or why plagues spread. Science has answered those questions. We now turn to God for answers to a handful of questions that science has never been able to answer, and probably never will. Why are we here? Where do we go when we die? What does all of this mean? And in asking those questions, we realize that like the ancients, we still worship a God of the gaps. We still have religion based on proof from incredulity. We cannot believe that all the beauty and order around us is the result of random connections of protons. So therefore, by proof from incredulity, the universe was created by some higher power. We cannot imagine it any other way. We're unable to conceive that when we die, all of our hopes and dreams and memories simply evaporate into nothing. So therefore, we have a proof that there is an afterlife, a proof from incredulity. These kind of big ideas are the great unifiers of religion. Every one of us in this room, regardless of our background, regardless of our religious upbringing, has had one of those moments when you stand under a starlit sky and you look up, and all you know is that what's happening up there is bigger than your understanding. And it's in those moments that you glimpse God. There's a famous thought experiment in which you take 10 deeply religious people from 10 different countries with 10 different belief systems, and you put them in a field. And you tell them to stare up at a starlit sky, and all of them will instantly agree the heavens are awe-inspiring and humbling. And in that fleeting instant, all 10 of them are gazing at the face of the same God. Unfortunately, the camaraderie doesn't last too long. These 10 people with their 10 different belief systems will eventually take their eyes off the heavens and turn to one another. And they will start discussing what they saw. And they will do what humans do. They will try to make order out of chaos. They will try to fill in the gaps. And with 10 people of differing backgrounds and beliefs, there will be some disagreement as to how to fill in the gaps. What do we name this God? What does he want from us? Which of his rules are the real rules? Whom does he favor? How do we please him? Eventually, this discussion turns angry. The experiment goes on, and in searching for common ground, all 10 religious people agree that they would describe their God as omnibenevolent, that is, all-powerful and all-good. So at last they have some consensus. This God is all-powerful and all-good. Unfortunately, wandering through the field is an agnostic scientist. This happens all the time. He wanders out, and he points out the absurdity of their shared belief in an omnibenevolent God. He says, look at the suffering in the world, the natural disasters, the starvation. Your gods cannot be all-powerful and all-good. If they were, there would be no suffering. Either your God is benevolent and powerless to stop the suffering, or he is all-powerful and simply too cruel to care. It's simple logic. These are the kind of thought experiments that spark great discussion, the kind of discussions that the Humanities Council tries to foster without any brawling in fields. Recently, I heard the Council will be launching a new initiative. It's called Shifting Ground, Religion and Civic Life in America. This initiative, according to its description, recognizes that people around the globe are grappling with their religious and civic identities and the role religion is playing in setting public policy. They're going to be talking about issues like high school science, gay marriage, abortion, stem cell research. If you ask me, what could be more exciting and what could be more important? These are the topics that make the headlines every day. Evolution versus creationism. How do we read the story of Adam and Eve in the face of modern science? How do we read the book of Genesis alongside with the cosmology textbook? There's stem cell research. You see that in the paper a lot. We can now manipulate human stem cells, and we must ask ourselves, which is more reprehensible to God, doing research on fetal cells or failing to use our God-given brains to fight disease? We've reached a point in human development when we must ask ourselves, how do we become a modern, science-minded society without losing our religion? Having researched a couple of novels about religion, I've pondered these questions a lot. I don't claim to have any answers, but writing these books has been a fascinating journey, and I thought I'd share some of the adventure with you tonight. About 15 years ago, I was living in Spain for the 2 years that I didn't live in New Hampshire in my entire life. Actually, I was in Los Angeles for 2 years as well. So that's 36 years total that I've lived in this state. Somebody can do the math. I'm 40. Oh, I'm 41. Wow. One morning, when I was living in Spain, I was studying art history at the University of Seville. And one morning, our professor began class by showing us a slide of Leonardo da Vinci's famous painting, The Last Supper. As you know, The Last Supper depicts Jesus and his 12 disciples sharing bread and wine during their final night together. I'd seen this painting many times, and yet somehow I'd never seen the strange anomalies that the professor began pointing out to us. A hand clutching a dagger, a disciple making a threatening gesture across the neck of another. The very unusual arrangement and architecture of the individuals at the table. And much to my surprise, a rather obvious omission. The apparent absence on the table of the cup of Christ, the holy chalice from which the disciples shared wine. The one physical object that in many ways defines that moment in history, Leonardo da Vinci chose to omit. So all of us are sitting in class, scratching our heads, feeling like we're seeing this painting in many ways for the first time. And that was when the professor told us that the oddities he had pointed out were really just the tip of the iceberg, and that we were about to be shown the painting's true shocker. I'm not going to tell you what that is, of course, but I'm hoping most of you have read the novel. If you haven't, my publisher would like your home mailing address. The professor went on to explain that the anomalies in The Last Supper were hints to an ancient historical secret, a secret that related to one of the most famous legends of all time, a story familiar to everyone in this room. He added that whispers of this secret had been passed along for centuries in countless languages, including the languages of art, music, and literature, and that one could find veiled references and clues to it in works by Mozart, Wagner, Isaac Newton, Botticelli, as well as in the pagan traditions of tarot cards and the songs of the troubadours. I became absolutely fascinated with the idea of a lost historical secret. But the further I progressed in my research, the more troublesome the information became. First of all, I'm something of a skeptic, despite what you might read in the Union Leader. I don't see any truth in stories of extraterrestrials, crop circles, or the Bermuda Triangle, or any of the other conspiracies that permeate pop culture. Second, I found much of the information very hard to accept, quite simply because the history I was learning about did not mesh with what I had been taught, both in school and in church. So troubled by these differences, I asked a historian how to balance contrary accounts of the same event, which happens all the time in history. You have contrary accounts of the same event. And this man responded in what I thought was a brilliant way. He made two very obvious points I had never considered. First, when we read and interpret history, we are not interpreting the historical events themselves. We are interpreting written accounts of those events. In essence, we are interpreting other people's interpretations. And second, since the beginning of recorded time, history has been written by the winners. That is, those societies and belief systems that conquered and survived. And despite the obvious bias in this accounting method, we still measure the historical accuracy of a given concept by examining how well it concurs with the existing historical record. I should add that many historians now believe that engaging the historical accuracy of a given concept, we should first ask ourselves a more fundamental question, and that is, how historically accurate is history itself? In most cases, we will never know the answer, but that shouldn't stop us from asking the questions. And nobody asks more questions than Leonardo da Vinci. Leonardo is often described, and this is a wonderful description, a man who awoke from a deep slumber only to find that the rest of the world was still sleeping. He was an artist, an inventor, a mathematician, an alchemist, a man centuries ahead of his time, perhaps the greatest scientist the world had ever seen, Leonardo da Vinci faced the challenge of being a modern man of reason born into an age of religious fervor, an era when science was synonymous with heresy. Men like Galileo and Copernicus, in studying astronomy in the heavens, were considered trespassers, invaders in a sacred domain whose mysteries previously had been reserved for the traditional scholars of heaven, the priests. The church believed that the magic of the universe, the stars, the seasons, the planets, these were evidence of God's almighty design. They were miracles and needed to be revered as miracles. They were not scientific riddles to be decoded with telescopes and mathematics. So you can imagine how the church felt about Da Vinci's pursuit to understand the science and mechanics behind God's creations. He was a man whose curiosity about the human body inspired him to visit church cemeteries, dig up corpses, and peel off their skin so he could study the musculature. His diaries resonate with a spiritual awe for the mysteries of plant structure, star movement, geologic phenomena, optics. He practiced alchemy, invented never-before-imagined machines, devised cryptologic methods for keeping information secret. And his life's quest was to concoct a formula for everlasting life. We have to assume he failed. But the church was not amused with his desire to find a formula for everlasting life. They considered it a heretical desire to cheat God of the final word. Surprisingly, despite Leonardo's long conflict with religion, he was a deeply spiritual man. Like Galileo, Da Vinci looked at nature's miracles, and in them he saw proof of a divine creator. His philosophy was one in which science and religion lived in harmony. And I should mention that this uncomfortable marriage of science and religion is something most of us are still trying to deal with today. Even now, science and religion both jostle to be the infallible source from which each of us draws our truth. Depending on what public school district you live in, your sixth grader's view of the universe might include phrases like Big Bang, planetary systems, evolution, or it may include phrases like in the beginning, let there be light, and Adam and Eve. Some of us feel connected to the divine when we see a crucifix or other religious symbol. Some of us feel connected to the divine when we see breathtaking photos from the Hubble Space Telescope. Some of us find our miracles in the pages of Holy Scripture, and some of us find our miracles in the pages of Scientific American. Unfortunately, I grew up the son of a mathematician and a church organist. Yeah. I was pretty confused right from the start. As a kid, I really wasn't sure which way to turn. Where science offered me exciting proof of its claims, photos, equations, visible evidence, religion was much more demanding. It constantly wanted me to accept everything on faith. And faith is a hard thing, especially for a kid. And so as a boy, I gravitated quickly toward the firm foundations of science. But the further I progressed into science, I took a lot of science at Phillips Exeter and on through college, the further I progressed into science, the mushier the ground started to get. And I'm sure those of you who have studied science have had this experience. When science starts tackling the tough questions, it starts using convenient phrases like uncertainty principle, margin for error, theory of relativity. Slowly, physics turns into metaphysics, numbers become imaginary numbers, and even matter itself starts to come into question. And I should mention that physicists now believe that matter, everything around us, is really just trapped energy. That this podium, for example, is nothing but pure energy manifesting itself in the shape of a podium. That each one of us in this room is pure energy trapped in the form of a human body. I'll add that these same physicists who proclaim that everything around us is energy are very quietly asking themselves if it is merely coincidence that the vast majority of religious texts, including the Bible, describe God as energy, and describe God as being all around us. I think if Leonardo da Vinci were alive today, he'd be pretty happy with the changing roles of science and religion. Right now, for the first time in history, the line between science and religion is starting to blur. Particle physicists exploring the subatomic level are suddenly witnessing an interconnectivity of all things, and they're having religious experiences. Buddhist monks are reading physics books and learning about experiments that confirm what they have believed in their hearts for centuries but have been unable to quantify. What I finally come to accept is that science and religion are partners. They are simply two different languages attempting to tell the same story. Both are manifestations of man's quest to understand the divine. While science dwells on the answers, religion savors the questions. Scientists often accuse religion of having no factual foundation, no firm data to back up its claims, no way to prove anything. At the same time, scientists sheepishly admit that religion is the single most positive force in the world, and that if science could invent a drug that decreased the rate of divorce, suicide, depression, and loneliness the way religion does, this drug would be hailed as the scientific breakthrough of all time. I've always been fascinated with the interplay between science and religion, and I think one of the reasons I became so engrossed in Leonardo da Vinci is that his fascination with those two fields. In all fairness, I should add that another reason I'm passionate about da Vinci is that I married an art history buff who happens to be a Leonardo fanatic. That Leonardo da Vinci, not DiCaprio. Blythe was an enormous help with the research of this novel, and possibly, just possibly, she had some influence over the novel's recurring theme of the sacred feminine and the goddess. So, you can guess who wears the pants in our house. As you may have heard, there's been a bit of controversy surrounding this book, and I wanted to talk about that for just a couple minutes. In medieval times, if you spoke up and challenged established church doctrine, you would quickly be labeled a heretic. Now, apparently, that is still the case. A lot of people are asking me about the avalanche of new books on the market attempting to debunk the Da Vinci Code. Decoding the code, cracking the code, breaking the code, refuting the code, you get the idea. My feelings about these books are quite simple. I think they are absolutely wonderful. These authors and I obviously disagree, but the dialogue that's being generated is a powerful and positive force. The more vigorously we all consider and debate the topics, the better our understanding of our own spirituality. Most theologians will agree that religion really has only one true enemy. And as my father said, that enemy is apathy. All of us becoming too busy to go to church or to temple or to our place of worship. Becoming so caught up in the chaos of life that we forget to let spirituality in, that our spirituality starts to take a back seat. Passionate debate is the antidote to apathy. Debate makes us think about what we believe and why we believe it. Debate forces us to actively explore our beliefs, which is invigorating and healthy for religion as a whole. Some of these authors who've written books seem absolutely certain of their truth, and for that I am envious. I was not born with the luxury of absolute certainty or absolute faith. I have a lot of questions. I've written a novel in which fictional characters ask some of these questions and offer possible answers. Since this book came out, I've been accused of all sorts of things, including being anti-Christian. I was raised Christian, and I sang in the choir. I went to Sunday school. I spent summers at a church camp near P. Porridge Pond, by the way. And to this day, I try to live my life following the basic tenets of the teachings of Christ. It's important to note, however, that if you ask three people what it means to be Christian, you will get three very different answers. Some feel that it is sufficient simply to be baptized into a Christian church. Others feel you must accept the Bible as immutable historical fact. Still others require belief that all those who do not accept Christ as their personal Savior are doomed to hell. Faith is a continuum, and we each fall on that line wherever we may fall. But by attempting to rigidly classify ethereal concepts like faith, we end up debating semantics to the point where we entirely miss the obvious. That is, that we're all just trying to decipher life's big questions, life's big mysteries. Where did we come from? Where are we going? What does it all mean? And each of us is following our own path to enlightenment. Most of us in this room tonight are probably Christian. However, there's nothing in our DNA that predetermined that. We were not born into the world believing that Christianity was the truth. We were born into a culture. We worshiped the gods of our fathers. If all of us in this room had been born in the mountains of Tibet, I think the chances are pretty good that we would all be Buddhists. Just guessing. And chances are also pretty good that we would hold on to that Buddhist philosophy with the same passion that we hold on to our current faith. We worship the gods of our fathers. It truly is that simple. The world is a big place, and now, more than ever, there is enormous danger in believing we are infallible, that our version of the truth is absolute, and that everyone who does not think like we do is wrong, and therefore an enemy. Prior to 2,000 years ago, we lived in a world of gods and goddesses. Today we live in a world solely of gods. Women in most cultures have been stripped of their spiritual power. Our world today is based on outdated male philosophies of absolutism. This kind of black and white thinking has a long history of violence and bloodshed, which continues to this day. I'm aware that there are those out there who disagree with my brashness in painting a picture, even in a novel, of a history that may not be exactly as we thought it was. Some of these people have created long, definitive lists of what they see as my shortcomings, my errors, my inadequacies. The media has a very high tolerance for controversy. And even so, all of this refuting and debunking of a novel has gotten so absurd, and in some cases hateful, that even the media seems to be getting tired of it. Several of them going so far as to quote Shakespeare, a certain line from Hamlet about protesting too much. Recently, one of my critics, a well-spoken gentleman who is a very devout scholar, went on a radio program and said he was there to correct the misperceptions put forth in the Da Vinci Code. He actually said he was fighting a holy war. He told the interviewer that he was angry with me for teaching inaccurate history. The interviewer, to his credit, pointed out that some scientists might consider this scholar guilty of the same thing, for teaching his children that evolution had never happened and that all of mankind sprang from two people named Adam and Eve. I don't claim to know where we all came from, but I do know there are multiple versions of that story, and I also know that that's okay. We all have the right to believe whatever it is we believe. And we are not only entitled to speak our minds, we are required. Because it is through dialogue and debate that faith, and I mean every faith, remains a living faith, remains an evolving and relevant spirituality. How can religion stay relevant in the modern world if having religion forbids that we use our intellect? Or if it demands absolute belief without permitting inquiry? Or if it proclaims answers but outlaws questions? As I've said, I was not born with a luxury of absolute certainty or absolute faith. I think readers are smart people. I think they're capable of deciding for themselves how much of this novel makes sense to them and how much they want to believe. And as for whether or not we're all getting a little worked up over this book, a very wise British priest noted recently in the press, "Christian theology has survived the writings of Galileo and the writings of Darwin. Surely it will survive the writings of some novelist from New Hampshire." So. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.